From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
The Indonesian army converged in two places.
Hundreds and hundreds of troops coming straight at the Timorese.
When they came, they opened fire.
10 years ago today, the Indonesian military opened fire on defenseless Timorese, killing more than 250 of them. Abortion clinics in the Midwest and Northeast received more than 200 anthrax threats. At the WTO meeting in Qatar, poor countries demand the U.S. put human rights over patent rights of drug companies as thousands protest around the world. All that and more coming up. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from the first Ground Zero. Afghanistan is the second. I'm Amy Goodman. Opposition forces claiming to have the ruling Taliban on the run press their drive in northeastern Afghanistan this weekend. The opposition Northern Alliance, backed by intense U.S. bombing and logistical support from British and U.S. special forces on the ground, has moved steadily across northern Afghanistan since occupying the strategic city of Mazar-Sharif on Friday. As they appear to cement their control of northern cities, Northern Alliance commanders have discussed a possible offensive against the capital city of Kabul. This as U.S. bombers continue to carpet bomb Taliban positions north of the city. U.S. officials have told the alliance to stay out of the capital while they pursue discussions with alliance officials as well as Pakistan and other neighboring countries on what kind of administration to install there. But officials of the Northern Alliance have rejected arguments they're unwelcome in Kabul, which was taken by the Taliban in 1996 after fighting among Northern Alliance warlords from 1992 to 96 reduced the city to rubble and killed tens of thousands of civilians. A vote-by-vote review of untallied ballots in the 2000 Florida presidential election indicates that George W. Bush would have lost Florida and therefore the presidency had Al Gore pursued and gained a complete statewide recount. The new data, compiled by the Associated Press and seven other news organizations, suggests that Gore followed a legal strategy after Election Day that would have led to defeat even if the U.S. Supreme Court had not intervened to effectively give the state to Bush. Gore sought a recount of a relatively small portion of the state's disputed ballots, while the review indicates his only chance lay in a course he advocated publicly but did not pursue in court, a full statewide recount of all Florida's untallied votes. The media consortium hired the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago to view each untallied ballot and gather information about how it was marked. The consortium used computers to sort and tabulate votes based on varying scenarios that had been raised during the post-election scramble in Florida. Completing two partial recounts that Gore unsuccessfully pursued in court showed Bush maintaining a lead ranging from 225 and 493 votes, meaning Bush still would have won if the U.S. Supreme Court had allowed a partial statewide recount to continue. But under any standard that tabulated all disputed votes statewide, Gore erased Bush's advantage and emerged with a tiny lead that ranged from 42 to 171 votes. The media consortium found that Gore outpolled Bush under all six scenarios for counting all undervotes and overvotes statewide. The consortium delayed releasing the results of this study for over a month as the U.S. launched the attacks on Afghanistan. The Washington Post is reporting that the American Red Cross collected hundreds of thousands of blood donations after September 11th, knowing the blood could not be used for victims of the terrorist attacks. After selling some of the surplus blood to hospitals, the Red Cross has begun to destroy thousands of pints that have outlasted their shelf life. Directors of several Red Cross blood centers said their sites may discard as many as one of every five donations, and the national total could easily reach tens of thousands. Although the Red Cross told the public that surplus blood would be frozen, it did not have the resources to freeze large amounts of excess blood, this according to documents and interviews. The Red Cross decisions in the days after September 11th created a standoff with other blood groups which opposed collecting unneeded supplies of a perishable product. Federal officials tried to negotiate a unified policy, but the Red Cross balked at a plan to encourage donors to delay their donations. The Red Cross has already come under intense criticism after it announced that it would be using more than 40% of the more than $500 million it's raised since September 11th to meet its own needs rather than the needs of victims and their families. President George Bush made his first speech at the United Nations this weekend, warning world leaders they were either with the U.S. in its so-called war on terrorism or against it. While everyone who spoke at the U.N. meeting condemned the September 11th attacks, many world leaders also expressed their opposition to the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan. Saudi Arabia's Prince Faisal also slammed the Bush administration for its backing of Israel and Bush's equation of Palestinian resistance to Israeli occupation as terrorism, saying, quote, "It's enough to make a sane man go mad." And South African President Thabo Mbeki said it was obvious that the fundamental conflict in the world today is the deprivation of millions, quote, "coexisting side by side with islands of enormous wealth and prosperity."
Running out. Time is running out. There is thunder in the air. I can hear the voices shout. The foundation is crumbling, and the people.
Time is running out, Wendy Smith, here on the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. Federal Express packages containing white powder and the threat, "This contains anthrax, you're going to die," arrived at more than 200 Midwest and East Coast abortion clinics on Thursday. The packages sent overnight from drop boxes in Virginia and Philadelphia marked the second mass mailing signed by the Army of God, an elusive group of anti-abortion activists who in the past have claimed responsibility for the murder of doctors who perform abortions and for the bombing of clinics. On the armyofgod.com website, the featured quote of the month is, "I'm an abortionist bomber, that's what I do," from Clayton Wagner, an anti-abortion extremist on the FBI's top 10 list of most wanted criminals. The mailings come less than a month after more than 250 similar letters were sent to women's health clinics in envelopes through the postal system. Because there have been so many anthrax threats against abortion clinics in the last 3 years, abortion rights groups have developed routines for notifying all clinics of the threats that have been received, and most are careful to screen their mail. Shortly after the first anthrax packages arrived at the National Abortion Federation in Washington on Thursday, they received a bomb threat and evacuated the building for more than an hour. Authorities testing the powder do not believe it contains anthrax or other toxins. But directors of Planned Parenthood, the National Abortion Federation, the Feminist Majority Foundation have requested a meeting with Attorney General John Ashcroft and Homeland Security Director Tom Ridge. We're joined now by Kodrak McCullough, who is an abortion provider at the Feminist Health Center in New Hampshire. She opened one of the FedEx packages last week. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you. Can you tell us what happened? When did you receive it?
We received the FedEx envelope about 9:30 in the morning last Thursday. And all mail is handled under strict protocol now at the health center as well as clinics across the nation. And the envelope was given to myself The address, the return address, as you have mentioned, was the National Abortion Federation, and I did not recognize a name above the return address, Cynthia Waters, though she was a clinic director at another clinic in a different part of the country. I handled it as suspicious mail, opened the package outside of the facility with latex gloves and a mask, found a number 10 envelope within the FedEx mailer that contained an off-white powdery substance on the top of the flap of the envelope, immediately shut it, and initiated our protocol for anthrax threat letters.
And what is that?
That is contacting organizations such as the National Abortion Federation, the National Coalition of Abortion Providers, the Feminist Majority, local and state and federal officials such as our fire marshals, the police, FBI, hazardous material teams, let everybody know right away what was going on. And we have an incredibly supportive, we're really lucky, incredibly supportive local police and fire, and they came immediately and helped us handle the situation with as little fanfare as possible.
How did you feel?
I definitely felt glad that I have had the training in handling suspicious mail and that I had the instincts to open it up outside of the facility. I felt proud of kind of the instincts that I had in that moment. But I also did have a small sense of fear and dread seeing that powder on the top of the envelope, but was able to handle it with just a sense of I knew how to handle the situation.
In the last month, when there were other anthrax hoaxes, the Attorney General, John Ashcroft, spoke specifically about them, said people would be prosecuted to the full extent of the law, that hoaxes were extremely serious and were crimes. I remember a Connecticut building that was cleared out, but I did not hear him mention women's health clinics. And I'm wondering what has happened since last Thursday. Still, even before that, there was another rash of these letters. Is that right? A few weeks ago, right at the time of CBS and NBC mainly, where more than 100 clinics got these letters.
Right. I understand that in the month of October, 280 anthrax hoax letters were sent out. So it was interesting that there wasn't as much attention to that rash of mailings as there is this one. Now, whether authorities are taking it more seriously because they were mailed FedEx and there might be a better chance of tracking the senders, I'm not sure if that's what it is, or finally tolerance for domestic terrorism there's been an intolerance for this type of behavior.
What is the Attorney General doing? He's a well-known anti-abortion activist. He has said in the past that his most proud accomplishment in his life would be to get a constitutional amendment that bans abortion. The silence from the administration around women's health clinics is deafening over the last months. So what are they doing? Have you met with John Ashcroft, for example?
I know that the National Abortion Federation has called for a meeting with John Ashcroft, and I know that they are incredibly impressed with the cooperation of the FBI and that they've prioritized this event and transferred it to the domestic terrorism unit. However, I'm not aware of what the next step will be in making sure that they get a meeting with Mr. Ashcroft.
I understand that Planned Parenthood Federation of America has asked to meet with Ashcroft since he came into office, and he has refused.
We are an independent provider, independent of Planned Parenthood, and so I'm not aware of what happened with that meeting, and I'm not surprised that he refused. I think that this administration is, you know, handling the abortion issue with kid gloves at this point, because they do realize that they're not only dealing with international terrorism, but they're needing to acknowledge, again, domestic terrorism.
Can you explain who the Army of God is?
The Army of God is apparently an organization made up of individuals who have independently and as a group worked to threaten and actually harm abortion providers and their clinics. Some of the individuals that are supposed to be associated with the organization are well-known names among abortion providers, such as James Kopp, who is still in France and is under conviction for the murder of Dr. Slepian, Michael Bray, who was accused of bombing several clinics and the National Abortion Federation's office. Donald Spitz is a spokesperson and an advocate for justifiable homicide, or the murdering of clinic workers and physicians. They hold a dinner every year that is, its point is to extol the work of anti-choice terrorist activists and honor them for being in prison for acts of terrorism against providers. So they're a pretty scary lot. People definitely to be taken seriously, even though these letters, again, have all turned up negative for anthrax at this point. There were a couple initial preliminary field tests that proved positive, but they think that they were false positives. So these were anthrax hoaxes again, but the individuals associated with the Army of God are to be taken very seriously.
I was very struck speaking to a friend who works at Planned Parenthood in New York after the September 11th attacks, asking how she felt. She was just saying that all the precautions that people are taking now at the networks and other places where the anthrax threats were, that you all have been living under this threat for a very long time, that their stuff is put through x-rays, that they change their routes going home. They've often changed their home numbers. They are living with a kind of threat that Americans now know in the last month for the last years. And very little is known about this in the outside world, or is it covered very much?
Well, for more than 20 years, abortion clinics and the providers of those services have been targets of terrorism. Our physicians and clinic workers have been murdered by religious and political extremists, and our centers have been attacked with bombs and dangerous chemicals. And as you know, since 1998, hundreds at this point, reproductive health facilities have been receiving threatening letters claiming to contain anthrax and bombs. And one thing that we've learned is that the ultimate goal of terrorists is not necessarily to inflict physical harm, but to paralyze us, to inflict emotional damage, and to divert us from our normal routines. So we also know that while we need to take additional precautions, it's just as important to continue living with a sense of spirit and optimism. And we'd like to let people know that, you know, that this is what we've become good at, is trying to avoid a sense of isolation and fear and panic. And you need to be able to talk to your family, talk to your friends, talk to your loved ones about the feelings that you're having around fear, and check out assumptions and find support and solidarity in the people around you.
Kudrick McCullough, I want to thank you very much for being with us, abortion provider at the Feminist Health Center in New Hampshire. She opened a FedEx package on Thursday that contained an anthrax threat with the statement, "You're going to die." You are listening to the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we're going to Doha, Qatar. The World Trade Organization meeting is taking place there, and there is protest there as well as around the world. And we'll end up on East Timor. Today is the 10th anniversary of the November 12th massacre of 1991, when the Indonesian military, using US M16s, gunned down more than 270 Timorese. We'll talk about state terror, and we'll have an extended program on this in our second hour. We'll be going to Dili, East Timor, and we'll be joined by a Timorese representative here in our Firehouse studio. Stay with us.
Now they take him, and they teach him, and they groom him for life, and they set him on a path where he's bound to get ill. with stars. Sell his body like they do used cars. Now there's a woman on my block. She just sit there facing the hill. She say, who gonna take away his license to kill? Now he's helping for destruction. He's afraid and confused, and his brain has been mismanaged with great skill. Now all he believes are his eyes, and his eyes, they just tell him lies. But there's a woman on my block, sitting there in a cold chill. She said, who gonna take away his license?
License to Kill, Bob Dylan, here on the War and Peace Report. This is Democracy Now! in Exile, as we break the sound barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, today is the fourth day of the five-day meetings of the World Trade Organization, which are taking place in the tiny island Gulf state of Qatar. The United States and Switzerland edge closer to agreement with developing countries demanding more leeway to override drug patents for health emergencies, one of the issues threatening to block new global trade talks. The dispute has dominated the WTO conference, where ministers are hoping to launch a new round of negotiations to lower barriers to global commerce. Pressure's also building to reach a compromise on other hot issues like anti-dumping rules and agricultural subsidies. Rich countries hope to come away from the WTO ministerial meeting tomorrow with an agreement on launching new trade talks, which they argue would give the faltering world economy a much-needed confidence boost. Developing countries are demanding more market access for their textiles and agricultural products in recognition that some past pledges of help have yet to be fulfilled. Brazil and India, which have large generic drug industries, are leading the push for a declaration that patent rights won't block poor countries from responding to AIDS and other health crises. The United States and Switzerland are loath to alter the WTO's intellectual property agreement, worried about undermining their own drug industries. Poor countries that don't have manufacturing capability can override patents and import life-saving drugs, but the exporting countries could face trade sanctions. Doha, Qatar must have seemed like an ideal location when the World Trade Organization chose it a year ago to host this week's crucial gathering of trade ministers. At the time, the main security concern on the minds of WTO officials was the threat of a repeat of the large anti-globalization protests in a country which forbids public protest. Qatar seemed the place to have the next protest for the trade ministers. We're joined on the phone now by Thatcher Collins. He's a correspondent with Free Speech Radio News in Doha. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Hello.
It's good to have you with us. So tell us what's happened in the last hours.
Well, this afternoon there was supposed to be a press conference by a group of Caribbean delegates, and that's been postponed twice. And generally that means that negotiations are still hot and progressing. And some of the Caribbean countries, namely Jamaica, were threatening to vote against a new trade round. And what this means is that with the postponed agreements is that they may be going back on that, or they may be that people are trying to negotiate them away from that position. So that's going on right now. Also, the EU, which wants stronger environmental clarification, but no changes, has decided that they don't need specific clarifications at this point, only that it will be decided that somehow they will negotiate in the new round, and that's a change for them. But that's what's happened in the past couple hours.
And tell us what has happened over the weekend. What has been agreed upon by these trade ministers, and what kind of protest or dissent have they faced in Qatar?
Well, as one delegate said, nothing has been agreed upon until everything has been agreed upon, because no one will make a firm statement about what they've actually committed because they're posturing and they say one thing in order to try to get maybe something a little bit less. And so they won't. I don't think anything's been decided. However, it seems that the TRIPS agreement is going very well, and that was the thing that was worrying most of the delegates here. That's really all they've announced, is that it's going well.
Explain what you mean by TRIPS agreement.
That's the trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights, and that regulates patent laws and like software and music and the patents on genetically engineered foods.
I understand that Vandana Shiva and José Bové held a news conference where they spoke, and I was wondering if you could play some of what they had to say for us.
Yes, but before I play that, I'll explain the background behind this, because it's rather interesting. Right now I'm in the NGO Center, which is a five-minute walk from the Sheraton Hotel where the conference is being held, and it's pretty isolated, and press rarely make it over here. There are meetings here all the time, and not well attended by the press at all. And when I attend, I'm frequently one of two journalists, if not the only journalist. And so what they've decided is that, well, they've come to the conclusion that they're marginalized over here, and have decided to bring their press conferences to the Sheraton Hotel itself. So as I was talking to you on Friday night, exactly that time was the beginning of the opening session, and they staged a surprise protest at that time and stood in front of the door as United States Trade Representative Robert Zolik was coming in, and they had their mouths taped with duct tape and were holding signs. And basically their idea, what they gave to the press, was that the WTO did not have a transparent process, and they were protesting against that. So they've taken that tactic, and they've done it every single day since. The day after, they also went to a press conference that was being given by Robert Zolik and stood outside in front of the door and blocked the door, and he had to leave out through a back door. And at that point, they were talking about the process that delegates have to go through from the third world and how they're marginalized and how other economic policies are used to strong arm third world nations in the WTO consensus process. Then on the third day, there's a tent just outside of the press room in the conference center, and they've moved all of their press conferences to there, or the big ones anyway. And this is from that. It's about it's a protest about TRIPS, and it starts off with Vandana Shiva, who is from India and the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Natural Resource Policy. Then it's followed by José Bové, who's representing Via Campesina, and then Asia Russell from ACT OUT. And then Vandana Shiva comes in at the end of this clip.
And there are many groups here who have spent the last 10 years decoding what the trade-related intellectual property rights agreement is about. It's basically a treaty to create monopolies over all of life, to empower the corporations who have already created monopolies in seeds and in medicine to now have monopolies on genes, on genomes, and all living materials. There is, in this conference, a particular attempt to undo the work that developing countries have done over 2 years to correct the deficiencies and perversions of the TRIPS agreement. The developing countries have used their mandated right in the review of Article 27.3b and the review of the whole of TRIPS under Article 71.1 to basically stop the piracy of third world knowledge, as in the case of Basmati and Neem, and there's an epidemic, there are hundreds of cases we have. The patenting of seeds, which has become the reason for highest levels of indebtedness in the third world, because the seed corporations are now the biotechnology corporations and they are also the chemical corporations. They sell the seeds that require more chemicals, and farmers are getting in deep into debt. And you heard the story of two farmers, but our organization has tracked the farmer suicides, and we have 20,000 farmers suicides in 3 years in India because of the policies of trade liberalization and seed monopolies. The second aspect, besides biopiracy, is related to the ethical issues of patenting life. And we have the biggest movements of the world, from farmers' movements, food security issues, ecological ethical movements, consumer movements, indigenous people's movements. We are very disturbed that the TRIPS debate is being transformed into a debate not of changing TRIPS and removing its efficiencies, but of upholding TRIPS and giving it a new lease of life. We want life's integrity defended. We want the integrity of third world innovation recognized and defended, and biopiracy made illegal. TRIPS integrity has to be sacrificed because it's an integrity of piracy, it's an integrity of predation, it's an integrity of pushing people with epidemic, victims of epidemic diseases to death, but also farmers to death. And we want to bring the whole issue of the relationship of this treaty with treaties that have already been negotiated under the Convention on Biological Diversity, the Treaty for Plant Genetic Resources in the FAO, and the details of these treaties, our colleagues here will give you. But we do not want an erasure of the work of other treaties, centuries of innovation by farmers, 2 years of negotiations on the review of TRIPS by an empty declaration that says TRIPS above all. We want life above TRIPS. Right.
That was Vandana Shiva, the well-known Indian anti-corporate globalization activist. This is José Bové.
Which is the union of farmers in the world. For all the farmers in the world, farmers from the developing countries, but also for the farmers from the developing countries.
French farmer.
GMOs and patent on life is going to kill all the possibility of the farmers to be able to have their own seeds, to be able to choose their own agriculture. For us, this is the principal fight. In this meeting in Doha, we're talking about TRIPS, and we are talking also about agriculture. But if we don't change TRIPS, it's no matter anymore to discuss about agriculture. So this is really the central point for all the farmers in the world. And this is why the farmers from Via Campesina decided all over the world to fight very strongly and to destroy all the crops we can find genetically modified crops. For us, this are actions to save the biodiversity of the humanity and the human rights.
That was José Bové.
And I'm from ACT UP Philadelphia, the Health Gap Coalition. We came to Doha because a central controversy at this ministerial is that poor countries are seeking an end to the grip exercised by multinational pharmaceutical companies and the wealthy governments that are restricting access to life-extending medicines and tools that promote public health in developing countries and in least developed countries. They have drawn a line in the sand demanding that nothing in the TRIPS agreement stand in the way of the public health. This is a modest proposal. This is a reasonable proposal, and we came to Doha because the obstructors demanding that the developing countries give in are the U.S. government, the Swiss government, and the delegation from Japan. We object to this. We say when intellectual property obstructs access to public health, access to essential drugs like AIDS drugs, malaria drugs, drugs for diabetes, drugs for cancer, patents must be broken. If no declaration can be come together by the end of Doha on TRIPS and public health, it will be the blame laid at the foot of the U.S. government, and this will pass into doubt the entire validity of the TRIPS agreement when it comes to patenting on essential medicine. And we say drug company greed kills, the greed of wealthy nations kills, and we demand access to affordable medications and access to public health tools for all people.
And the drug companies are the seed companies, are the biotech companies, and they kill through seed monopolies.
Vandana Shiva.
Genome monopolies, they kill through medicine monopolies.
Right.
We want the TRIPS debate in its full-fledged ethical implications, ecological implications, implications for food security, farmers' livelihoods, and the health rights of the people. All these on the table. They are the mandated review. We will not tolerate the brushing under the rug of these critical issues that have been raised by the peoples of the world
We will not let an empty document go out of Doha. We want to reclaim the right to life of all people and all farmers, including the right to accessible seed, the right to accessible food and affordable food, and the right to affordable medicine. Food, seed and medicine, that is what we stand for, and monopolies that steal this from us will not be tolerated. Thank you.
Break the monopoly.
And that ended with Vandana Shiva. And there are a few more points about these protests that I should mention, that this protest had a die-in street theater, and someone dressed up as Basmati rice, and they had people pretending to be dead farmers. The day before, they had a mock WTO meeting in the process, and during that the protest yesterday, there was a press conference next door, and no one attended that conference, instead came to this one. And so the European Union Commission members who were giving that press conference came outside to the protest, and when it was over, one of the members stood up on a chair and begged people to come over to his press conference. Essentially, they stole the show, and it was obvious. And I went into his press conference, and at that point, he openly asked for people to comment and critique their policy, which he hadn't done the day before at the same press conference. And as for media coverage, this has been getting extensive coverage in the third world press, but not in the first world or developed nations press. It was on Al Jazeera, for instance, but it wasn't on BBC.
Well, Thatcher Collins, I want to thank you very much for being with us, correspondent with Free Speech Radio News in Doha, Qatar. Again, the people we just heard, among them José Bové, French farmer and unionist. He is the man who led other farmers just before the Seattle protests in his home community of southern France, when the United States imposed sanctions against France for not allowing hormone-injected beef into the country. And those sanctions included raising tariffs on Roquefort cheese, the only area in the world where it's made, is José Bové's area. He said it would wipe out the whole regional economy there. And so in protest, he and other farmers went to the local McDonald's that was just being built, and they dismantled the golden arches, bringing them to the local prefecture, leaving them on the front yard, went home, were put in jail. And as they sat in jail, they became national heroes in France. Now José Bové in Doha, Qatar, with Vandana Shiva, the Indian anti-corporate globalization activist Asia Russell of ACT UP, and about 50 other leaders of the anti-globalization movement who were granted permission to attend meetings in Qatar, while thousands of others were kept out. But that hasn't stopped them from protesting, as people are involved with protests and other kinds of actions around the country around the issue of the WTO. On Friday, several hundred activists in New York marched in Midtown Manhattan, visiting the offices of several corporations like Citibank on a corporate tour of shame. And in California, it was a day of Another World is Paintable. And among those who were active in it was David Solnit with Action for Local Global Justice. And he's on the line with us right now. What did you do around the World Trade Organization, David Solnit?
We had 3 days of action on Thursday the 8th, the day before. Five affinity groups fanned out through the Bay Area and dropped banners over Bay Area highways during rush hour to let everybody know about the following actions, and also because the issues had been largely blacked out in the mainstream media, to let people know that the WTO was meeting the following day and going to try and push forward what we had stopped them from doing in Seattle. So that was on Thursday. On Friday, we held a march and festival in San Francisco with about 700 people marching on Pacific Gas and Electric Company. And we've been focusing on the local impacts of our local communities of corporate globalization. So here we are focusing on Midway Village and Bayview Hunters Point, fighting a toxic waste site that their houses were built on, and then respectively a toxic power plant. And we took over the front area in front of PG&E occupy the entire street and proceeded to turn it into a giant mural against both the WTO and PG&E's impact on those communities.
Explain the concept of another world as paintable.
Leading up to the actions, we did a mobile mural project called Another World is Paintable, and we went to communities throughout the Bay Area, to schools, and we asked people to graphically paint their vision of alternatives to corporate globalization, alternatives to the problems in their communities, and came out with a bunch of very beautiful, compelling, and motivating images of the kinds of lives and worlds people would like to live in that are very different than the one we live in now.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, Henry Clark will be joining us from West County Toxics Coalition in the Bay Area as well. And then we'll go to Seattle to find out about what WTO protests look like there, almost 2 years after the major battle of Seattle. And finally, we're going to end with East Timor. We'll spend the second hour on that issue. And we just got this news just in. An American Airlines 767 has crashed in the Queens Borough of New York City. Port Authority officials say the plane was bound for JFK Airport. Thick black smoke is billowing over the area, and local media are reporting several houses on fire. We'll bring you more on that story after the break. Stay with us. Jimmy Cliff, we all are one. I'm Amy Goodman here on the War and Peace Report. Again, the latest news just came over the wire. American Airlines 767 has crashed in the Queens Borough of New York. Port Authority officials are saying that the plane was setting to land at JFK Airport. Thick black smoke billowing over the area. We'll continue to bring you more on that. Henry Clark with the West County Toxics Coalition, can you give us the latest on how you're connecting local issues to international issues?
Yes. Here in Richmond, West County Toxics Coalition was part of a broad coalition that sponsored a big march to say no to the World Trade Organization and to globalize justice, not war and toxic pollution. We focused on the Chevron refinery here in the Richmond community. That's had been a long-standing problem to the community from their polluting activities that have caused a wide variety of health-related problems in our community here. Chevron pretends to want to be a good neighbor to us in Richmond, yet when we consult with their friends and allies in other parts of the world who were also represented at a demonstration, for instance, people in Nigeria who was also addressing problems from Chevron operations in Nigeria, as well as friends from Ecuador that are dealing with the joint Chevron and Texaco operations that were left over there that contaminated the environment. So our protests had an international flavor to it, and we basically wanted to educate people in our community about the World Trade Organization and its policies and how it would affect us locally, not only in regard to Chevron and energy issues, but also the possibilities of privatizing local services, which Richmond now is in the midst of a controversy already, where there's a firm based in Paris, France, that's trying to take charge of the city's wastewater treatment plant, and residents are organizing against that. So we have a good sense of how the World Trade Organization policies can affect us locally. And we had a major spirited demonstration with about 1,200 high-spirited marchers from all over the Bay Area that marched to the Chevron refinery for international festive program.
We're also joined on the telephone by Emily Riley with the World Trade Organization protest in Seattle. Again, the latest news we have as we're going back and forth between two stories, a major plane crash in Queens, New York. There was a plane that was just about to land at Kennedy Airport, American Airlines 767. It's crashed into Queens. At least four houses are now on fire, and we're going to continue to bring you that story. JFK, Newark, and LaGuardia have been closed. The crash happened about 30 minutes before I'm broadcasting this now. Again, it was on its way to land in JFK. JFK, Newark, LaGuardia airports all closed at this point. Emily Riley, just 30 seconds, what you were doing in Seattle.
We had a protest that we had a Somali grocery store that was raided on Wednesday by local and federal police. And the Somali community had a demonstration at INS, and we rerouted our march. We were originally going to tie in the prison industrial complex with the WTO, but we rerouted our march to be in solidarity with the Somali community, and had an incredibly beautiful day where we came together with them and connected what's happening right now in terms of the war on terrorism and corporate globalization.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Emily. I understand that some Somali businesses were in trouble in Seattle, and you expressed solidarity with them.
Yes. There was a small grocery store, and part of it was a travel agency and a money transfer service, and apparently they were accused of laundering money to bin Laden. And everything was taken out of the grocery store, including the refrigerating systems and the shelves, and they were holding a picket line, and a few of us happened. And, hello?
We're here.
Okay. And a few of us happened to go down there and be on the picket line, and decided to connect everything that was going on, and it was really wonderful.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. We are cutting this short as we are trying to bring people also the latest news that is happening here in New York. A plane crashed. It looks like at about, looking at the clock here, around 9:15 on its way to land in JFK. It was an American Airlines 767, crashed into houses. At least four houses are on fire. Now JFK, Newark, LaGuardia have been closed. The crash happened about 30 minutes ago. We're going to play you a clip now on this 10th anniversary of the Indonesian massacre of Timorese, November 12th, 1991, of what happened on that day. And when we come back, we'll get more information on the plane crash. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. This comes from a documentary that I did with Alan Nairn, a journalist, after the massacre of Santa Cruz.
Journalist Alan Nairn and I returned to East Timor last fall in order to be present for a historic event. A special delegation from the United Nations and Portugal was due to visit East Timor. The Timorese hoped the visit would finally lead to UN action and enforcement of the Security Council resolutions calling on Indonesia to withdraw from East Timor.
We were told in place after place that the army had been holding neighborhood and village meetings to warn the Timorese that if they tried to speak to the UN Portuguese delegation, they and their families would be killed. And Bishop Bello, the Bishop of East Timor, told us that the threat was, "We will kill your family to the seventh generation."
But despite the threats and a dramatic increase in disappearances, torture, and deaths, Timorese had prepared to speak out. They had met in secret, making banners and petitions for the delegation. When the army tried to hunt them down, many had gone into hiding and sought refuge inside churches. But under pressure from the United States, the visit of the delegation had been called off. 3 days later, with the world spotlight removed, the army stormed the Motayal, Dili's main Catholic church, and killed a young man named Sebastio Gomez, who had taken refuge there. And then came the morning of November 12th, the two-week commemoration of Sebastio's funeral. A memorial mass and procession were planned to lay flowers on Sebastio's grave. After the mass was held at the Motayal, people, young and old, came out into the street, and in a land where public speech and assembly had been forbidden for over a decade, they started chanting. The Timorese then held up banners drawn on bedsheets. They had been prepared for the delegation that never came. The banners called on Indonesia to leave East Timor and said things like, "Why the Indonesian army shoot our church?" The Timorese were facing a gauntlet of troops that stretched the length of Dili. It was the boldest act of public protest occupied Timor had ever seen.
More and more Timorese joined the procession. They came from huts and schools and offices along the way. And there was this building feeling of exhilaration as well as fear among the Timorese. And when they reached the cemetery, the crowd had swelled to maybe 5,000 people. Some went inside to lay flowers on Sebastiao's grave. Most of the crowd was still outside. And then suddenly someone looked up, and we saw that marching up along the same route that the Timorese had come came a long column of Indonesian troops, dressed in brown, holding M16s in front of them, marching in a very slow, deliberate fashion, hundreds and hundreds of troops coming straight at the Timorese.
Alan suggested we walk to the front of the crowd between the soldiers and the Timorese, because although we knew that the army had committed many massacres, we hoped that we, as foreign journalists, could serve as a shield for the Timorese. Standing with headphones on and microphone and camera out in full view, we went and stood in the middle of the road, looking straight at the approaching troops. Behind us, the crowd was hushed as some Timorese tried to turn away, but they were hemmed in by cemetery walls.
The soldiers marched straight up to us. They never broke their stride. We were enveloped by the troops, and when they got a few yards past us, within a dozen yards of the Timorese, they raised their rifles to their shoulders all at once, and they opened fire. The Timorese, in an instant, were down. It was torn apart by the bullets. The street was covered with bodies, covered with blood. And the soldiers just kept on coming. They poured in, one rank after another. They leaped over the bodies of those who were down. They were aiming and shooting people in the back. I could see their limbs being torn, their bodies exploding. There was blood spurting out into the air, the pop of the bullets everywhere. And it was very organized, very systematic. The soldiers did not stop. They just kept on shooting until no one was left standing.
A group of soldiers grabbed my microphone and threw me to the ground, kicking and punching me. At that point, Alan threw himself on top of me, protecting me from further injury. The soldiers then used their rifle butts like baseball bats, beating Alan until they fractured his skull. As we sat on the ground, Alan covered in blood, a group of soldiers lined up and pointed their M16s at our heads. They had stripped us of all of our equipment. We just kept shouting, "We're from America." In the end, they decided not to execute us.
The soldiers beat us, but we actually had received privileged treatment. We were still alive. They kept on firing into the Timorese. We were able to get onto a passing civilian truck, went into hiding, but the Timorese who had been with us there on the cemetery road, most of them were dead.
Inside the cemetery walls, Max Stahl, a filmmaker on assignment with Yorkshire TV, had his video camera running.
The soldiers began at that point to encircle the entire cemetery. I saw soldiers as they gradually moved towards the middle, picking out people who were wounded or taking refuge between the tombstones. And when they got to them, they beat them and assembled them in the back of the cemetery. People were stripped to their waist. They had their thumbs tied behind their backs. And they were made to look at the ground. And if they looked up, they were immediately beaten, usually with a rifle butt.
Max Stahl was filming near a crypt in the middle of the cemetery. Some of the wounded and those too scared to run were huddled inside praying. As Stahl filmed, he buried his video cassettes in a fresh grave. Then he was arrested by the troops.
Whilst I was being interrogated, I observed these trucks driving by with more people in them. These people were clearly in a kind of paralysis.
You've been listening to the massacre of East Timor that happened 10 years ago today. That from the documentary Massacre, the story of East Timor, I produced with Alan Nearon. More than 270 Timorese died. I'm having the strangest experience now of listening to this and then also listening on radio and television to the latest news that we have just heard, and that is that a plane has gone down in Queens. It just had left Kennedy Airport. It was headed to Santo Domingo. It is not a 767, as we reported earlier. It's an American Airlines Flight 587. It looks like an Airbus 300. It crashed into the Rockaways in Queens. It's not clear why it happened. All three airports have now been closed in New York, LaGuardia, Kennedy, as well as Newark. And I was just listening to the mayor speaking on the radio. In our last minutes, we're joined by Joe Nevins, who is on the telephone, who has written a piece that talks about the two ground zeros. Maybe eerily, we don't know what is happening right now with this plane, but Joe Nevins, are you there?
Yes, I am.
What has happened now with this American Airlines flight, but you talk about two ground zeros, World Trade Center. Well, we've got Afghanistan, and then you talk about East Timor in this last minute before we go to our new hour.
That's right. In September 1999, many international observers described Dili, East Timor as ground zero as well. In the aftermath of a United Nations-sponsored referendum that took place there by which the people of East Timor, after almost 24 years of a brutal military occupation, were able to decide their political fate, the Indonesian military went on a rampage, unleashing a campaign of terror and destruction. In the immediate aftermath, they destroyed about 70% of East Timor's buildings and infrastructure, forcibly deported about a third of the population to Indonesia, where tens of thousands of them still remain, and raped untold numbers of women. In addition to massacring what is conservatively estimated to be about 2,000, but most likely the figure is much higher. As I said, many people call this ground zero. Now, the difference is in New York, ground zero was created over about 20 minutes. In East Timor, it took place over about 3 or 4 weeks in the full view, for the most part, of the international community. And it wasn't until September 11th, 1999, exactly 2 years prior to the terror in New York City.
We have 10 seconds.
That the Clinton administration cut off its weaponry. So that's the big difference, is where the big players in the international community were involved in the making of Ground Zero in East Timor. Now they're on the other side. But the reactions are very different.
Well, we're going to take this on in our next hour. We're also going to take on the latest news. Again, plane crash in New York City. A plane that was headed away from Kennedy Airport had just taken off, headed to Santo Domingo. An A300 Airbus looks like it went down in the Rockaways. Not clear what happened, if there was an explosion on board or what. It has crashed into a number of houses. There is a major fire in the Rockaways, and we don't know how many people were on board. It was American Airlines Flight 587. We'll bring you the latest as we continue today. That does it for the program. Program produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy, Anthony Sloan, our engineer and music maestro. You can reach us by email at mail@democracynow.org. In our next hour, we're going to look at this 10th anniversary of the massacre of Timor, and we'll bring you the latest news on the plane crash. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. Listen.